I met another guy, and who is now one of my very best friends, Tyler. We started a trucking company, and we started a vacuum truck company. We built it up, we sold it off, and then.
Now, how old are you when you start the vac truck company?
I believe I was 21 when I did that.
Yeah. That's insane to me.
Yeah, it was a risk for sure.
Yeah, but did you realize it was a risk at the time, or are you just 21-year-old kid going, man, watch this?
No, I was very calculated with it all, and I absolutely had $0 to my name, you know. And,
yeah.
And Tyler at the time, he was 24, I believe, so it was rough. And my grandma, I started with a $15,000 loan from my grandmother, who absolutely had no money as well. So
she gave you everything she had.
Yeah, it was a gamble, man. It was. And it worked out really good. It really did.
Man, that's awesome. And and so from that early age, and what do you think gave you that mentality of, man, I'm just going to do my own thing? Was it living out in West Texas where that's a very common thing?
Yeah.
And you see a lot of people that, you know, maybe live next door to you and now they've ascended to, you know, true wealth? Or was it watching your dad own a business, or what was it, do you think, that gave you that mindset at that age? Because 21 is young, dude.
So I was born with the sickness called trying to make money at everything I do. And it is. I could have any hobby in the world, and while I'm having fun with that hobby, I'm sitting there thinking, how in the world can I make money doing this?
How can I monetize this?
So I grew up out West Odessa, right? So there's a lot of chicken out here, a lot of stuff going out here with farming and, you know, stuff like that back in the day. So when I was going into junior high, you know, we weren't the most well off. We lived a dang good life, but, you know, I wanted the nicest things. So what I did is I started breeding chickens at the age of 12. And that's how I'd buy my school, like nice school clothes and stuff like that, you know. And then I got into dairy cows, started flipping them in the newspaper at the age of like 14. So I've always had it, and I've always just had the drive to build things and watch it grow, you know.
Sure.
My dad's been the same way, and so has my mom. But we really didn't start doing the whole business thing and you know, and growing it until we just kind of all teamed up together, and that's when it really took off.
So at 21, you start a vacuum truck company, which that's an interesting segment of the trucking industry to jump into.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely very common oil field need. And if you don't need a whole lot of customers to do really well with a couple trucks.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And so you say it's a calculated risk. So what was the name of that company?
It was Tyco Petroleum Services.
Tyco Petroleum Services. Yep. So you build that up over how many years?
Just a couple of years, 2 years.
And then sold it.
Yeah.
So now you do have some money.
Yeah.
Hopefully you paid grandma back.
Oh yeah, she got her money back pretty quick. So. Yeah. She did.
Did you sweeten the deal when you gave her money back?
Grandma still gets money to this day.
You gotta do that.
Yep.
So everything, you're back square now. Now you got a little bit of money. Then what?
So during that time is when my dad and me and my mom got together and decided we were gonna buy my dad's partner out. Well, his partner wanted to keep the rigs, and we kept the tubing testers and scanners.
Okay.
And we started Stealth, and that was in 2011. And that's when we teamed up, and we're a hell of a team, and we grew that thing together. And now we're one of the biggest in North America at what we do here at Stealth. So we're really proud of that, pride ourselves on it. Branched out into several different divisions. Got some big things coming next week for Stealth that we hadn't really talked to anybody about, but it's going to be pretty phenomenal. So,
man, that's amazing. Yep. And so you went from the vac truck, you take that, you partner with your family, which, I mean, there are real horror stories with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are also these kinds of stories.
Absolutely.
To me, I always thought, why wouldn't I partner with my family?
Yeah.
I mean, if I can't trust them,
Then who can you
count on? And so then you guys start Stealth, which is blown up, man.
I mean,
Stealth is awesome.
Appreciate it.
And you know, I first came across you. There was a picture of you at Aaron Marquez's house.
Yep.
Standing next to Lindsey Graham, making him look this tall.
that was a great night.
Yeah. And I was like, man, there was something about you. And so so I was like, I'm gonna follow that guy. So I'm gonna watch. And then, man, just it was always very intriguing to me, you know, your backstory. I didn't really know your backstory. And so then what's interesting though is that even at the age of 12, you were like, man, I'm gonna do something.
Yep,
right.
Yep.
And it was that mentality that I had, there's this stuff that I want, and I'm just gonna figure out a way to get that.
absolutely. And that's what it was, you know. I had the hunger for the nice things, and I wanted to figure out a way to get it. But now it's not so much that. My thing is watching things grow, helping people grow, you know, and I absolutely love that. So now I have this deal. It's open door policy, and I have that with my employees at every company, but it's also with just your everyday people who have an idea and want to start something. And that's how I've started several businesses, was people coming in my door and saying, hey, I got this idea. You got a minute? And I'm, absolutely, let's talk about it. Let's figure it out. So we took some big risk, and most of them have paid off for the most part. Not all of them are home runs, but, you know, most of them have, and it's been great. It's really cool.
So building teams around problems to solve a specific problem, I began to learn how to do that at a very early stage in my career, and it is true to say that that was all luck. The opportunities were luck, and I had people that seemed old to me at the time that were my age now that they gave me those opportunities. Right. Like the baby engineer, you know, like 98% idiot and 2% something, some other creature, right. You know, and so
less idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. And so so I had people early on in my career who said, Mush, go do this.
Yeah,
but, you know, and for whatever reason they said that, and so that gave me lots of opportunities to do that. And I had some along the way as I was learning to sort of construct teams and take on problems, etc., that now help me today. I had some, like, monumental screw-ups. Like, I am talking spectacular, I should have been fired screw-ups. And one of my favorite stories is, so one of these experiences, I think I was in my early 20s, still like maybe 24 years old, and I had a project to replace a heat exchanger that's on the side of a distillation column. And anyone that's been in the refinery or the chemical plant environment knows what I'm talking about. So I made a mistake in some measurements. Okay, and so this heat exchanger went out for like 3 days to get its repairs, and it came back. And keep in mind, the economic penalty was like hundreds of thousands of dollars per hour.
Sure,
like, this is like...
You're burning cash.
You are burning cash. And so, you know, and like the CEO of the company knows, you know, D2220's heat exchanger is out. You know,
he's getting briefed on when that's back online.
Right, yeah. He's wondering like what idiot do they give this job to. Well, that, you know, that was me.
Yeah, what's a mush?
What's a mush? Yeah. Yeah. We shouldn't even be employing something called mush. Yeah. And so, you know, and so he, so I had this job and so I mismeasured like an inch off. And so, you know, so down it comes and out it goes. And
yeah, it's basically restart that whole thing. Yeah.
Story gets better. So, comes back. So this time instead of
better is an interesting word, but
yes. So like it was like instead of this, it was the other side. Yeah, I screwed up like in reverse. So not technically the same mistake, but it was like the opposite of the mistake I made.
Is the picture negative of the mistake?
It was. Yeah. So the guy I worked for at the time.
First of all, that's what engineers do. What you just did.
What's that?
It's not the same mistake.
No, that's right.
It's the exact same mistake. You know?
Yeah. No.
That's completely Justin.
Yeah,
different.
Come on.
It's a completely different.
Let's remain technical here. So
yeah, I apologize.
Yes, that's okay. And so, like all the engineers out there, like yeah, Mush is right.
Yeah, he's absolutely right about
absolutely
that.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Yep.
And so, yeah, he's wrong in magnitude the same way, but in direction not. You know,
so it's completely different.
So those vector geeks out there. So like Ralph Villeman, who was the maintenance manager at the time, he was like 6'3", 6'4", like John Wayne,
just Texan. An imposing human.
Oh God, I was so intimidated by Ralph. So intimidated.
But you were a kicker for LSU. How is that possible?
It's hard to believe that a kicker would be intimidated by anything. So Ralph calls me, like on the radio. So we have these implant radios.
Right.
He's like, Mush, what's your 20? I'm like, oh crap, this is not good. Ralph is calling me. Like, what's your 20 means what's your location.
Yeah, where are you?
But what he meant was come here now.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, wherever you are,
right.
Be here.
Be here, like now.
Now.
And so I, you know, traveled over there on my little plant bicycle. And then he lets me know what the problem is. And he gives me the biggest public dressing down I've ever experienced in my life. And this was like, you couldn't do it today, but you know, he used some choice words about my background.
It was 100% deserved.
100% deserved, yeah. Like, yeah, really well deserved. And so, and it really was. It was a complete, it was not, here's what I should have done. I should have had someone who was used to taking these measurements take the measurements. But I was too damn arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, I can do it. I can do it. Well, it's just a tape measure. You know, I can mm-hmm. operate a tape measure. Couldn't, obviously.
Clearly not.
Yeah, right. And so so I made a mistake there. And so he gave me a massive dressing down and, you know, kind of like went to the core of my existence, you know. So, you know, I was like, whatever sort of arrogance was in me at the time.
He took care of that.
Yeah, like sword went in, out came the arrogance.
Right.
And so, and Ralph was, if you can believe it, I think he did what was necessary for me, you know, in that moment in time. He knew what I was doing. He was a very, very smart guy. So Ralph gave me this dressing down, and I was just like completely wrecked, you know. Mm. I think the lowest point in my life, literally. And
not just your professional life. My life. This is it.
I'd never experienced anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so... So I'm sitting in my trailer, and this was back when you could have a trailer in an operating environment. Now you wouldn't do that for safety reasons. But so I'm sitting there. By now it's like 7 o'clock in the evening, and everyone's gone. And you know, I'm like, oh man, I'm getting fired. I'm getting fired. I just know it. What am I going to tell my parents? You know, all this stuff. And so the door opens to the trailer, and I hear footsteps. I'm like, well, here it comes. Here comes the firing.
That's right.
You know.
Right.
And so Doug Mathera, who was the plant manager, came in, and Doug was, I think, like the son of a West Virginia coal miner, and didn't say a lot. You know, when he spoke, he, like, those words were, like, really yeah. went through you.
He was very efficient.
He was very efficient with his words, that's right. And so Doug came in, and he looked at me, and like, slouched in my chair, and he's like, what's going on, Khan? And he never called me my first name, always called me Khan. Just to be extra imposing.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and so, and I told him what happened, and of course, you know, he absolutely knew.
He
knew what happened, yeah, for sure. He knew the first time, and he definitely knew the second time.
Right, right.
You know, so he probably heard Ralph yelling from his office at me. So I told him, and Doug could see I was clearly upset. And Doug, and this is such sort of a dichotomy of experiences, and as I think about it, like this was beautifully designed for me at the time.
Right.
So we had Ralph, who gave me a dressing down,
mm-hmm.
But not with malice, if you can believe that. But it was the appropriate dressing down, like at level 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then Doug comes in and he looks at me and he said, "Don't worry, I'd buy Khan stock." That's all he said, you know, and so. And immediately, I had like the rush of confidence. Like, here's a guy that I just absolutely admired and respected and worshipped in many ways, saying that he would buy Khan stock. Like, he would buy stock in me. And the message that he was telling me at that time is like, hey, man, you're down, but I'm a buyer of you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an investor in you.
Yeah.
I think back, and as I have thought back about that experience a lot, that's really what it was. And so I think... you know, a lot of people would be lucky to have those experiences that I did, and I was was given those experiences. I didn't create them.
Sure, and you're sure he didn't mean like Khan's Electronics?
He could have meant that. I mean, that really has like crushed this entire multi-decade vision I have now. So now that you mention it, maybe he was like being literal in a different way. So
yeah,
thanks.
Well, yeah, sorry
there
about
goes
that.
There goes my confidence.
Well.
I'm shutting alchemy down. That's right. It.
Well, you're welcome, I guess.
Yeah. Good success. Yeah. Successful podcast. Another yeah. business crushed and yeah. another soul decimated.
the alternate reason I started this.
We buy the company January 30th. I think here it comes, money time, game time, and then COVID, March 11th, 2020. So 6 weeks after we buy this company, the world collapses. So everybody knows what you did on March 11th. You went home, you didn't touch, you started freaking out, 2 weeks to kill the curve, you know, whatever bullshit they told us that didn't
right.
turn out to be true. And so I spent a week at home, you know, in like I was supposed to, like we're all supposed to. I spent 5 days and my wife was like, go to your office.
Go away.
Go away. You're annoying me. There's nobody in your office. Go to your office. So I'm like, fine, I'll go to my office. So that next Monday, I went to the office, and nobody was there. I was very panicked, very, very panicked. All of the businesses had shut down. All of people were freaking out. There was no such thing as PPP at that point.
Right.
There was, it was a very terrifying time. I mean, I'm sure everybody remembers this. And if you're a business owner, you definitely remember this period. Like, nobody knew what was going to happen. And you know, look, we're not debt ridden, but at the same time, like, cash flow is important.
Absolutely. So, in any business.
Yeah. So, I mean, a month of no, and by, we didn't stop paying our people.
Oh, they're mowing now.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
That's awesome.
It's looking good. So I'm, you know, so I set out to, where am I at on this story? So
you're still paying people. Things are going great. I mean,
we're not cutting salary. We're not doing anything yet. We're just holding pattern. I mean, it's only a week into it. So we're not, there's no reason to do this yet.
Yeah, you're paying attention to it, but you're not like, ah.
Well, I mean, I'm more freaked out than others, I'm sure. Cause again, I own the business outright at this point. I've got, you know, all the liabilities on me. I've got 5 years left on leases. I mean, there's a lot of cash. I've just expended a bunch of free cash to this other business. Right. I mean, like it was a tight situation made tighter.
Right.
So, I'm up and down the hallway and we have a very long hallway, and I'm just up and down, thinking alone, up and down. And I'm talking to myself. I'm thinking out loud. I'm zoned in. I'm just pensive. And all of a sudden I go to the very end of the hallway and I'm just looking down. And I remember thinking, each office is a person. Each office is a person. Like that's a family in that office.
Mm-hmm.
And back to the point about caring about people. And I'm like, each office is a person that I need to care about, that I need to think about. And I was like, Josh, you can't, going back to the whole, you know, when have you ever challenged yourself, right? Like, you cannot crawl into a hole. You cannot walk away.
There's no option to quit here.
There's a whole story to that moment here in a minute. I'd been through a kind of a company issue 2 years prior to that. It was so devastating to me and my wife and just the family that I had gone through a moment where nothing could have been more detrimental, really, at that time, where I remember telling my wife, the only way out is through. And if you don't say that to yourself as an entrepreneur, the only way out is through, all the time, then you haven't been challenged yet, and you will. And when you get challenged, remember that the only way out is through. No one's coming. That's what I told myself walking up and down the hallway. No one is coming to save you.
Yeah.
No one is going to save
you. It's on you.
No one is going to save you, Josh. No one. And that was a tough realization. That was a very tough realization of that I don't have a safety blanket. I'd left my family business. And not only that, I'd competed against my family.
Yeah. And they're not going to welcome you back.
Well, I mean, I'm welcome, but it's not like, you know, I don't get to tap into that.
Right.
Trust fund.
Right.
Right. Like that's a separate fund that I'm not.
That ship sailed.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have access to that. So, no one, I remember saying, no one is coming to save you. So what are you going to do? And then I said, I think all these were out loud. I say these things out loud. No one is coming to save you. What are you going to do? And then I said out loud, I said, what are you going to do? And I said, this one could kill you, meaning killing the business.
Yeah.
And I said, this one could kill you. And I go, and I want to be very clear, all of this was out loud. And I said, this could kill you. What are you going to do? And I said, if this kills you, you're going to go out fighting. So be prepared to fight. And then I immediately flipped from woe is me to how are we going to fight? What am I going to do?
What does fight look like?
What does fight look like? So then I started looking at all these desks, and I thought about how my wife had kicked me out of the house after 5 days. And I thought, you know,
I bet other people are getting kicked out too.
I bet other people want to get out of their house. And I have a phenomenal home office.
I do too.
Yeah, I've got a great, it's quiet, I can close doors. I mean, it's great. I can separate. But I know friends that don't. They're working at a kitchen table, and this is, you know, Zoom or whatever was still really early on. And I was like, I bet a bunch of people don't have a great office set up at home, and they have babies and they want to get out. So I called everybody. I called, you know, large company CEOs, truly. I won't mention their names, but, you know, men and women that you know that are big on, that are big industry leaders were in our office. I said, if you need an office, come to my office and you can use the facilities. You can use a desk any day you want. I've got 25 desks.
Right.
Printers, office. We can socially distance because that was kind of a thing.
Right.
I said, you can behind the glass so everybody will be safe. And we, and that's what we did. So some days we'd have five people. Some days we'd have 25 people. Dude, it was amazing. We would have commercial real estate guys. We'd have medical guys. We'd have lawyers. We had the CEO of a major publicly traded company.
There's an industry agnostic group of folks.
It didn't matter. Yeah. It didn't matter. And people were meeting each other for the first time. And you had only got, you had everything in there. So men, women, you know, young, old. It was the most active office in all of Houston during COVID. I guarantee.
How did you get comfortable with, like you said, burning the boats and taking the island? Like, how do you get comfortable?
There's only one way to do that. There is no comfort planning. Level. There yeah, is. Yeah. You just have to take that deep breath and just jump, because it was at that point where we're saying, I could be doing this better, more effectively, mm-hmm. You know, for a better purpose. And the only thing holding us back is just that one decision of saying, okay, I'm going to wing it. I'm going to do it myself. And we did have to come to terms with, like, you hear all the stories and it sounds like so exaggerative when people are like, oh, you have to be willing to face bankruptcy. You've got to be willing to do this for entrepreneurship. But it's like so factual.
Yeah, sure.
Like, take that so seriously, people. Yeah. If you want to be an entrepreneur, it is going to be like the worst day of your life every third day of the week, because shit changes like that mm-hmm. quick. But also, like, there's been times where, you know, we think to ourselves, okay, we have this many days left until, you know, funds are running low and we've got to think of other options. And so it's like every day is just a fight to get to that level.
Sure.
And then to build it up beyond that, because we have so many friends who are so deeply ingrained into the business plan and so supportive and involved that it's not just our plates that we're thinking of. Like, when we're doing business, we're like, oh, I've got 10 plates to feed tonight sure. because our buddy and his daughters and whatever it might be. So that was kind of like what drew, like, was our pushing factor, was that it's not just us.
Yeah, and it would be like easy to come up with excuses not to do it.
So easy.
But yeah. the thing I that's easier than that yeah. is, like, when you burn your ship, like, you're going to be in the water for a minute until you get on the beach. It's like while right. you're drowning in that water, like my Jeep, we almost lost my Jeep. I literally did the payment one day before they had to elevate it the next one. And it was 3 months behind. And we were both sitting there like, dude, like, it's about to go bye-bye. Like,
yeah, yeah.
We're about to be down to one car. We had to fix this.
But to us, that was also
stuff
worth
on
it.
The house. And because, we were like, yeah. we're about to sink right now. But we're so far in right now. We're young enough to where if we get bankruptcy, who cares?
Who like, cares? Start over.
We'll go back. Like, we know sure. she can get a yeah. job easily.
I was working an over six-figure job, like, without a problem. So for us, it's like this is a voluntary suffer where mm-hmm. we're like, yeah, we don't have the groceries we want. We're eating cheap. You know, we're not going out ever. We're not wearing the coolest clothes. But we get to this point where it's like it's worth it, because in the future, it's not only going to benefit our lives, it's going to benefit, you know, our children's and generation,
sure.
friends mm-hmm. and family, and like that culture that's missing in so many corporations that we see. Like, that's what we're working. That's what we're building.
So what are you doing now? And what, you know, tell the ZFIS, yes. and that means something. I'm sure of it.
Oh, it does. I don't know if we're podcast we're ready for this. But I guess it goes with the spirit of things.
Sure.
The ZF stands for zero fucks.
Clearly.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you're at that point where you're at your lowest, you're at the bottom, and you don't have a choice. I mean, mm-hmm. what's the choice? You give up or you get up. And so for us, it's like you just have to get to the point where you don't give any fucks. To make it happen,
right?
And those things are just trivial compared to where you're going.
The failure is zero option.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't even enter. It's not a factor.
No,
at all.
No, it's not mm-hmm. a choice. It's not. It's not a consideration. So that's where the ZF comes from for ZFIS.
And then the nonprofit that you guys have. Tell me a little bit about that.
This is Olivia's baby, so yes. this is going to be
right.
I was already taking a deep yeah. breath, prepping.
You had your chance to speak. Now just hang up.
Yeah.
So the Relentless Revival Safe Haven, that is our nonprofit, and it's going to be, soon to be, a long-term sustainable safe haven for human trafficking survivors, and it's going to have an 18 to 24 month long restorative care program. So personal and professional development, specialized therapy, you know, either like addiction therapy, trauma therapy. We'll do animal assisted therapy, art therapy, and then economic empowerment through mm-hmm. internships and guided networking and career coaching to get them to that point where when they're done with our program, they have an idea of exactly who they are and what their strengths are and where they're going to go from that point on. Long-term goal is to have an emergency placement facility as well. So if you can kind of imagine like a 24-person barracks, and we want to have like
that's a lack.
Yeah, it's an extreme need.
Speaking to the people who already have the safe havens and stuff, the mm-hmm. one thing that's needed to help with it, like, yeah, there's not enough long-term facilities, but right now they're recovering these survivors, right? They finish their interviews and all that kind of stuff. They're just like, okay, like...
You can go.
Yeah, like, you're where free are to they go. Supposed to go? They've been...
Well, they're going to go right back to where
exactly.
they were.
Exactly, if yeah. they do. Right, and if they do, they're going to be beat up. They're going to get their money taken away.
It's going to be horrible.
And if they don't, then they've got the clothes on their back and the streets.
And there's this tower of power, and wherever they were, when they leave and come back, they're right back to the bottom.
Yeah. Right.
So they lose have no options. Everything. So it's not like a... hey, reach out for help and guaranteed I'm going to get help.
No, it's like we are probably not going to have help for you. We will not have help.
Like, so now it's a gamble for them. Like, I understand from their situation now, like, I don't want to gamble if I'm alive technically right now. Like, my life might be absolutely horrible.
It's terrible, but I'm alive. Yeah,
exactly. Or, and I don't know if I can get better. I don't know if I can have something better than what I have right now.
Or if I even deserve something better.
Exactly.
There's so much brainwashing mm-hmm. that goes into that type of a thing.
They just trauma bond them to the max.
It's terrible.
It's horrible, yeah.
Yes,
and we've heard some stories that are like, literally, like if I would see it on a movie, I'd be like, dude, that's too fucked up. Like, I don't want to watch that.
It's
and
the
I'm like,
darkest.
I can't believe it.
It's
I
the darkest thing.
I literally can't believe it.
I used to live next door to an FBI agent that was a cybercrime agent, and I didn't even stop to think about what he dealt with until he and I were talking one day, and I was like, so what do you just deal with, like, embezzlement or whatever? He's like, no, man, like kiddie porn. And I was like, oh, well, never mind then. I'd never want
to
talk about it.
You're dealing with the people that have to hide from the public.
Right.
That go, you know, to the cyber world.
His point that he made to me was, imagine going into a home of someone that you've never been in their home, and when you walk in, you just feel it is a gross place. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know.
Yeah. Your skin crawls.
It just feels gross in that place. Yeah. And so, man, that's amazing. I think it's sadly something that is needed, right? But it's great. And so those three things will go together. They'll complement one another. And one thing I've noticed about entrepreneurs, I've said this on another episode, is that entrepreneurs tend to be some of the most giving people. They always, it's like, oh man, we're going to give back.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to give back when you're working under somebody. You're not making enough, or you don't have that ability to direct money or direct energy.
Yeah,
especially energy, because that's really what it is. Mm-hmm. It's most often it's like
it is energy, because by the time you get to the point you can give back, how much energy have you given to get to that point?
Yeah. A lot of it.
Exactly.
For sure.
So you finally get to that point to where you're like, hey, I can give back,
but
I have
I'd
nothing left inside of me to even care about anything at this moment.
You spend 20 years there, and then you decide, you know what? I'm going to start a business, or...
Yeah, it's an interesting story, because, again, it kind of leads back to our relationship. 2009, my wife and I made the decision to move our kids. We had a growing family at the time from Southern California, Ventura County area, to Parker, Colorado, where we had some friends. Towards the end of my career at Anthem, it became very apparent that I was taking a look at my life, and I was saying, mm-hmm. you know, I've got still probably 30 years left of working, and I've done a lot, and I've achieved, you know, many milestones, mm-hmm. even more so than I could have imagined. I have a wonderful boss and great team. But I was just lacking in motivation and ambition, because I didn't have a clear vision of what my life looked on beyond the kind of current role that I was in. I couldn't see beyond that, and I had done.
And you're thinking, am I going to do this for the next 30 years?
Yeah, you certainly take a look at that.
Sure.
Two things is, one, I had to lay off half my staff, and many of the staff that I've had relationships for 15, 20 years mm-hmm. growing up in the company. And having to tell your staff that they're being let go after, in a lot of cases, 30 and 35 years. And this is all they've ever
for,
known.
For no other reason than there's a business reason. It, right. Yeah, that's tough. And I'm lifelong oil and gas, and we are no strangers to being laid off. When times are good, they're great. When times aren't, they're just not. So
right.
You're right. That is awful.
Yep. And then I was seeing, so you know, that was a pivotal moment, and it really got me thinking. The other moment was when I heard some of our older individuals on the team, you know, getting up 60, 65 years old, see some of them retire and then come back, and you know, having lunches with them, which is amazing to see them again. Mm-hmm. And then they're just like, wow, I spent so much time in one company, one industry. I really didn't learn beyond, you know, my first 15 or 20 years, which was, you know, again, where I was at in growth. Beyond that, I did the same thing
every single day
and over again. And now I'm retired and I still have people and memories, but now the people are so embedded into their day-to-day job that you lose connection.
Correct.
And you think you have this work family all figured out and it's going to carry you to the next 30 years. So I'm like, wow, that's a very telling moment in my career to say, one, am I going to grow as an individual? And am I going to expand? And am I going to learn new things? I think that it coupled with, man, do I want to be that person at 65 that says, man, this was my life. Your identity is wrapped up in that corporate job,
and there's so much comfort there too, right? There you is. Know, this is here, man. I can do this for another 30 years. Might be a slow death, but I can do it,
right?
And we'll live very comfortably for the next 30 years.
Right.
But yeah, it's certainly scary.
It is, and there's no, to your point, no safety net, no insurance for the family, so. Yeah, it was truly a leap of faith, as, mm-hmm. as one would say. And I think that's where my mind kind of goes to, is risk versus reward. And for us, we were willing to risk it all, mm-hmm. to say, let's give it a shot. We place a bet on us. And a lot of people, you know, they're not willing to do that. And I get it. But again, for us, that moment where we said, is this the next 30 years of our life?
Mm-hmm.
And for me personally, if I'm not growing, I'm dying inside.
Right.
And so my spirit.
Yeah.
Justin was, I was in such an entanglement.
You just felt crushed. Oh, yeah. You're just like,
man, I knew I had to do something, whatever that looked like.
Right.
I knew, you know, I'm a faithful guy. So, you know, I looked to Christ, me personally. And so I knew from a faith perspective that, hey, God's got me.
This is the example, like I have, like very personally, of why it's not a great idea in all cases to burn your ships. Mm-hmm. And it's, had I had the ability to leave the Army right then and there,
mm-hmm.
I got the entrepreneurial bug. This was it. This was the future. Let's roll, baby. I would have fizzled out,
right?
Because there wasn't the money coming in to do the thing, because it didn't make sense economically to do 5 years ago, right? So what the Army allowed me to do.
And to your point earlier, the market wasn't ready for that anyway.
It wasn't ready, which is like the you know, error number one is, you know, you're taking a huge risk to do stuff when the market is ready.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's a big risk to just survive when the conditions are perfect for you. If you're taking a bet on a bunch of future technologies that you're tied to,
yeah.
One of those shits, like, you're done. Like, it's a horrible idea.
There's going to be all these future technologies, yeah. And we're going to make them work all together.
Right.
But they don't exist yet, but promise it'll work.
Right, right. Like, that, like, oh, why would you burn your ships? Like,
right.
For
that's
that,
fair,
right?
That's fair.
And so... The other thing, like the third thing, so like one is just like the obligation is what, you know, was what it was, so get over it. The second thing was like this was a major swing for the fences.
Sure.
That was almost certainly not going to work.
Yeah.
And the third thing was, and this actually is what ended up happening, having someone else, like having a job
mm-hmm.
enabled us to, you know, every dollar that we got, we pushed just into R&D. So there wasn't like me and my lifestyle that I had to support or family that I had to support at all.
Right.
So every investment dollar, every grant dollar, everything that we've ever gotten, we just pushed back into the company that furthered research and development. And it wasn't like, oh, I need to pay rent.
Right.
Right. Right. So, you know, some people could say that like that's chicken shit entrepreneurship or whatever, but it's like, I would rather live in a country and live in a world where people are, you know, don't take that one swing for the fences, strike out, and then like kill themselves or like never think about entrepreneurship again. Like, because the failure rate is so high, like how do we, if we have to fail, one, like let's try not to fail. But then, you know, let's just, beyond that, it's like, hey, how do you have more people swing, even swing for the fences? And then if they strike out, like not starve to death. The gap between, you know, you trying to swing for the fences and do the startup life and versus like the opportunity cost of, you know, you working for the man is huge, right? So it's like, maybe you could go and make $100,000 working for the man and you're not going to do that. So you're going to do the startup world. Okay. Well, now it's that other version of you 1 year later is $100,000 richer, right? And it's not only are you not making any money, you're burning money, probably personally, right? So now that delta might be 150K and then you're going to do it for another year.
Oh, and that's 300. Yeah.
Right. Right. And now you're at 300, and now
it's not cumulative; it's additive at that point.
Exactly right. Right. And then there's also like, you know, a lot of other costs to entrepreneurship, like buying a house.
Sure.
You know, when you tell anyone that's not in the startup community like you're an entrepreneur, that's code for I'm unemployed. You know what I mean? Like that's not a thing, right? Like you can brag to your friends and post on Instagram or whatever that like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. But
hustle life.
Right. Hashtag hustle life. Wait, like, but like a lender hears, oh, you're unemployed.
Oh, you have no job.
Oh, you have no job. You have no way of paying. So like, go fuck yourself. You're like, I'm not going to give you this loan.
Right.
So like, maybe I'm in the wrong circles, but I've never heard anyone say that about entrepreneurship, about specifically like, if you want to do this lifestyle, you need to figure out alternative ways to buy a house because you're probably not going to do it the way that you want to do it.
Right.
And so like, that's just like one of 1,000 examples. So now that this delta is growing at year two, and then you fail.
Yeah.
Hard. You burn out, mental breakdown, whatever. That's not even talking about like the family stuff. Like maybe, you know, maybe your wife leaves you or husband leaves you or whatever the hell. And like now you're starting back from square one. But the trajectory now is just kind of, you know, between your other self is just kind of separating.
Yep.
Because now you've got 2 years of corporate or whatever, 5 years of corporate experience. Now you're getting, you know, groomed for whatever, vice president, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's diverging. Even if you can make it work, you don't have those bones, that you don't have that foundation. Yeah. Like even if you're a successful entrepreneur young and maybe multiple successful time founder, you still might have a little bit of imposter syndrome in you. You know, I think I would advocate first of all, do a better job of figuring out the, you know, people want what you're pretending to do or sell or make or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like it seems like a pretty reasonable starting block, but especially in the tech community, you know, like I've found like there's so many startups find a solution and then go looking for a problem. They get wrapped up around a thing and then they're like, oh, this is going to save the world. And then like, they don't show it to anyone. They go away in their ivory tower, right? And there's like a lot of mental masturbation that happens. And then they pop out and like no one was interested in what you're, because like, or two people are, right? It's like, well, okay. Well, turns out like that wasn't super important.
Yeah.
I think for some reason, some people grow up where their compass is just correct, and some people grow up where it's a little wobbly, and mine was a little wobbly.
Yeah.
And but they said the situation you're in today is a direct result of the choices you made yesterday. And man, it pretty basic stuff.
Right.
Earth-shattering for me. Earth-shattering, mind-blowing. Blew my mind.
You'd never even considered that.
No. No, I was just somehow a victim of this, or I was just floating through. I didn't really think about it, but but when it was just really clear, it's like, wow, you know, I am responsible for this. So then I thought, okay, well, And I used to have this whole thing wrote up about this, right? It's just kind of a fleeting thought. But I said, well, if what I did now is creating a trajectory to my future like this, if I make a different choice, I can alter my future. If the condition I'm in today is the result of this decision I made yesterday, if I make a different choice today, I can alter my future.
Yeah, if my condition is a lagging indicator, I can fix that.
Yeah, so then I start saying, okay, that's future one if I don't do anything. Future two is if I do this. Future three, future four. And then all of a sudden, I just open up an array of endless future possibilities. Because if my actions create the future, and if I have control of that, then I can steer and go where I want to go.
Yeah, the Waller multiverse.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to give you an example. Today, you see me in a T-shirt.
Yeah.
When I go to work in an executive role, I put on a button-down shirt with a collar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you know why a collar's on a shirt?
No.
I'm pretty sure it's to hide the colored ribbon that you tie around your neck called a tie.
Yeah.
I can't understand why I have to wear a tie, and why do I need a collar for a tie for an ancient ritual to wear a silk ribbon around your neck so you couldn't be offensive so they could yank you.
Hmm.
Don't grab my tie, I'll whoop your ass.
Is that what that's for?
That's what I heard, but let's be honest. Why would a collar exist on your shirt with a flap and the buttons? It's all made to hold this decoration. I don't want to be decorated. I don't want to play that game, right?
That's fair.
I don't want to do it.
That's fair.
But I had to.
But you can, though.
But I can, and I will, and I look nice in a suit, and I feel good in a suit.
And I think that's important for people to understand is that I had this conversation with my youngest daughter, and I said, man, to get anywhere in life, learn to be comfortable in any situation, have conversations with anybody, and hold your own in all of them.
Yeah, look, I don't care who's watching this, if they're trying to get better, if you're 18 or 38 or 40, get a good fitting suit, man. You're going to need it for something. No, get a good fitting one. When I met Don introduced me to dynamic work design. That's when I learned another really good trick. And it's a trick that I'm careful about saying because you can't abuse this trick.
Mm.
But Jerry Austin came to me and said, I need you to reduce the time from when drilling moves off to when you're selling gas by 90%.
Oh, wow.
In 90 days. Don teaches me these tools, man, and they start letting me get things done without Six Sigma, without lean, without calculated math. And what really happened was it helped me have a better conversation with people.
Gotcha.
Right? It helped me talk about things being on or off target. You know, at BP, we had a stoplight, you know, green and yellow and red. And Don said, I don't understand that. Yellow, what does yellow mean? It means I'm nearly failing or I'm almost winning.
Yeah.
Yellow's gone. So I don't have a yellow light anymore. You're on target or you're off. I don't do yellow.
Yeah.
We're on or off, man. And if you're off target, people are trained up, that's bad. It's not. It's just off target. Okay, what do we do to fix it?
It's a different conversation. You know, hey, why and what are we doing? And is the target realistic? You know, those types of things.
Let's watch this because the train, when you look at a giant train wreck, it wobbled way back there.
Sure.
Let's catch the wobble.
Go from five guys sitting around a whiteboard to, okay, we want to be in manufacturing supply of downhole tools, maybe some services, and then now you're doing $80 million acquisitions. So how does that journey happen?
Yeah, so, you know, Warburg is different in that they're not a traditional, private equity company. What they do is they look for leadership teams.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they do is they, if you get to that point where they say yes, they give you what they call a line of equity.
Okay.
And that's what you would be kind of authorized to spend up to, right?
Yep.
I think our initial line was like $325 million, mm-hmm. which is, I remember when they said yes and we were talking, it's like, can you believe that somebody gave us $300 million to go spend? What?
Who would ever do that? Good grief, man. I'm questioning their capabilities at this point. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
We had a couple of near misses. And then we finally closed on the first acquisition, was Tercel. And I remember the day we did it because it was Cinco de Mayo that we signed the paper.
Nice.
That was 2016. That was the first acquisition we did. And then it really took off. We did, our three biggest ones were Tercel, Logan Oil Tools, and then a top coat.
So was that always the plan when you guys started? Okay, we want to do, obviously, downhole tool, manufacturing supply, some services, whatever, but we are definitely going to be actively looking to acquire. Was that from jump, that's what we want to do?
Yes. That was the entire premise, was we wanted to build something to be competitive in that space to an NOV or somebody like that. We wanted to build it to scale. We wanted to be global. And we want it to be big enough to eventually, you know, take public.
I mean, obviously, you've dealt with large staffs through the acquisition process and those types of things. This will be interesting because we bring people on straight into the company. So it's not like you bought another company that has these people. What are you going to do to ensure that they carry forward, you know, your vision? Because that's what you're hiring them to do.
Actually, it's pretty funny. I learned a lot about that from Rubicon because, you know, even though we had, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, you had all this money and you were buying this. Yes, we were buying companies. But, you know, other than the three largest acquisitions we had, we were buying, you know, small companies. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to do things kind of a different way. So, you know, being an entrepreneur and bringing people into a small company that doesn't have resources, you have to find that right person. And I remember we had a number of people that we would hire at Rubicon that would come in from Schlumberger and all the big three or four. And I would always tell them, it's like, this is different. Like,
yeah,
you know, you don't have a staff to go and create like, oh, I want a new PowerPoint presentation for this product or that. It's like, you have to do that.
Yeah, you do that.
You don't have a database. Like, I'll give you the resources to do it, but in terms of the data, but like, you're going to have to go create this yourself.
Right.
And people would always say the same thing. Oh, that's why I want to leave a big company. I want to be part of something that I can be from the ground up, and I want to be able to create that. But then they get into it and they're like, well, where's this and where's that? You're like, you have to go do it.
Go build that.
And they're like, oh, like, you were serious. It's like, yes.
Yeah. Dead serious.
So I got a lot of experience in that, and I think that's going to help me with the people that I pick for bits, because you have to have people that can do it themselves, that they really are, you know, they're self-motivated, you know, and they want to be able to do what it takes to kind of get that done.
So our service members wanted to go and help, but they couldn't, so I decided I'm going to put a small team together of people, all special operations veterans that I knew very well, trusted, had the experience to do this, and we put this 12-man team together to go get Aziz. And as we're planning to do it, one of the guys says, hey, that's like 3,500 orphans in this camp that are going to be left there. Let's go get them too. And we kind of paused for a second and said, man, we have like over a century of like incredible like special operations experience in this room. We all have the passion, the ability to do this. We have networks and resources. Like, we could help a lot of people. Let's help as many Americans, women, children that are vulnerable, interpreters and their families, Christians that would be killed for their faith. Like, let's help as many people as we can. And so after that decision was made, the only way I know how to describe it was just completely like miraculous, because every door that should have been closed was open for us. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley's office, mm-hmm. Gave us permission to land on an airport and start evacuating people. The United Arab Emirates, the royal family, we called them and said, hey, will you help? We need a place to bring these people to, because they won't have visas. Like, mm-hmm. we can't human traffic people out. Like, we need a humanitarian center to bring them to. They said, yes, you could use our humanitarian center. Not only that, we're going to give you doctors and food and take care of them, but you're going to need some planes too. We're going to give you a C-17 plane, which is a big military plane, and pilots. Like, and then I got a call from Glenn Beck, and Glenn Beck's, you know, a longtime friend of mine and been supporter of Mighty Oaks. And he said, I just went in the air and raised money because I wanted to do something. And I just raised $21 million and I don't have I'm not rescuing people. Like, what are you guys doing anything? I'm like, yeah, in fact, we are. He ended up raising like $40-something million. Those planes, were like $800,000 a piece. And so I just worked with his guy, Rudy Atala, and they didn't give us money. They just paid the bill on the planes for us. And so within the first 10 days there, the first day we got Aziz and his family. We got about 180 people. The next day we got like 800. The next day like 1,000. It was all a blur, because we felt like we stopped for like 5 minutes or even 30 seconds to sleep. Right. Like somebody's going to die.
Yeah.
It was that fast. And we had our ground team going outside the wire, getting people. It was all coordinated. Everybody we brought out, by the way, was vetted. Our list was vetted. And then they went to Abu Dhabi where the State Department moved. So we didn't bring anybody unvetted to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Our government did. Tens of thousands.
Sure.
But everybody we brought had to be vetted because we're not the State Department.
Right.
And so we had an amazing team doing that process, running our manifest by Joint Chiefs. It was just incredible how everything went perfect. Any one of those things would have went wrong, and we would have had people killed, or we wouldn't have been successful, would have been shut down. But everything just went perfect. And at the end of that first 10 days, when the Abbey Gates blew up and 13 of our service members were killed and they started welding those gates shut, we didn't know how many people we had got out in that 10 days, but we ultimately tallied it up, and we had got 12,000 people out.
Wow.
And we made a decision in that moment that we couldn't leave. The U.S. military was leaving. The troops were not wanting to leave. It was embarrassing mm-hmm. for them. I mean, watching them evacuate our embassy, pull down our flag and evacuate the embassy like Saigon. It was terrible, and our troops were – one of the things, our troops were forced to clean the airport for the Taliban, clean the toilets, and for the it was just so disgusting. We were so mad, but one of the things that we knew is we couldn't leave because the news was saying, and the White House was saying, there was 100 Americans there.
Yeah.
And I knew, being on the ground, that there were thousands of Americans right. still there. And 100 or 1,000, it doesn't matter. Like, the United States has a promise to American people that we won't leave you behind. Not one person. And the world I come from, special operations, is like, literally, we will scorch the earth around an American to get them out. So I could not consciously leave. And our team couldn't either. We chose to stay. We were flying people out of remote airports through a coalition of a lot of other nonprofits that worked with us, some great nonprofits, not just ours. And we got about another 5,000 people out. And that's kind of how it ended for us in Afghanistan. And now we're in Ukraine,
yep.
doing the same thing in Ukraine. You know, we were able to rescue Benjamin Hall, the Fox News reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I personally drove out Pierre, the cameraman, 25-year cameraman from Fox News, his body, to get him back safely to his wife, Michelle, who wanted her husband.
Sure.
And then we've rescued a lot of people, and now we're bringing Almighty Oaks team out to the front lines and providing resources, supplies, training, and ultimately our biggest thing is our spiritual resiliency program for those troops, because they're mentally and spiritually, like,
for the Ukrainian troops.
For the Ukrainian troops, yeah, they're hurting, and and they're just trying to defend their homes and their families and their freedom. And most of them aren't professional soldiers; they're just normal everyday people that are just defending their homes and families. Yeah. I want to say something to say the heart of all those people is a Sea Spray, who I mentioned earlier, special forces guy and one of our premier government and intelligence agencies, just probably one of the most qualified guys on our team to do particularly precision rescue operations. Not probably, he was the most qualified guy. And I was together with him. We've been doing everything. I did 10 trips to Ukraine since February, since the invasion, and he's been with me every time. And we were getting interviewed, and just really just gives the heart of everybody that was involved. He was asked in an interview a question that we always been asking: why are you doing this?
Right.
Like, why are you helping these people? You don't know these people. You could die. Like, and you don't even know these people. This isn't your country. Why are you doing this? And he said, kind of what we always say is, because it's the right thing to do, and
right.
It's the right thing to do to help people that can't help themselves. And if you can, you should. And then the reporter asked another question that I hadn't heard asked before, and this is his answer. She said, is it worth it? And he said, it doesn't have to be.